Before we get started, I would like to bring your attention to the next Americano Live event. The last one was a huge success, and we anticipate this one will be as big, if not bigger, to get all Trumpy about it. It's Americano Live's Trump's First 100 Days. I will be hosting it, and I will be joined by the great Lionel Shriver. We will be talking about all things Trump. There's a hell of a lot to cover, but we'll do our best to cover the lot. Do join us. It's at the Emanuel Centre on Wednesday, the 30th of April. And the discussion, according to the blurb here, the discussion starts at 7:30 p.m. Book your tickets at spectator.co.uk/Shriver, which is spelt S-H-R-I-V-E-R, as I'm sure you already knew. Please come.
Welcome to Holy Smoke, the Spectator's religion podcast. I'm Damian Thompson. My guest this week is Quentin Letts, the beloved and brilliant parliamentary sketch writer of the Daily Mail, former theatre critic, former New York correspondent, a man of many talents, which include having just published a gloriously funny and poignant novel called Nunc, N-U-N-C. They are the first words of the Nunc Dimittis, now lettest thy servant depart in peace. And that's appropriate because the bulk of the novel is the story of Simeon, the old man in the temple, who utters these words as he holds the baby Jesus in his arms. This is Herod's temple. It's just been built and it's just before the slaughter of the innocents. But in fact, Quentin, the novel opens in 20th century England.
It does. It opens in a city, perhaps, not entirely unlike Hereford, my local city, cathedral town. And it opens with a 62-year-old corduroy-trousered Englishman being given some rather bad news that he's dying of cancer. And he has a row with his wife. He has a few pills, painkillers, goes off to the wine bar, as some of us do. And after an hour or so of sinking hock, he's tottering home and he sees that his local cathedral is about to have evensong. And he puts a head into the cathedral and the choir are just practicing, finishing their practicing for evensong. And they are singing the Nunc Dimittis. And he listens to the music, one of the great canticles of our time, of our faith, and he...
It's the Stamford setting, isn't it?
The Stamford setting, Stamford in B-flat. And his mind swims, his imagination is unhooked, and he then imagines himself in 1st century BC Jerusalem, which is where Simeon, the prophet Simeon, lived, of course, his time. And Simeon was the old man who was told by an angel that he was not going to die until he had seen the Messiah. And he waited and waited and waited at the temple in Jerusalem, a bit like a good wicketkeeper waiting for the ball that was going to come through. And eventually it did, of course. And eventually Simeon lifted up a baby that had been brought to him by a couple from Nazareth. And at that moment, Simeon knew that he had seen the future. And, of course, it was slightly mixed news for Simeon that he also knew that it was curtains for him. Anyway, that was the world. But this makes it sound an unremittingly religious book. It's not unremittingly religious in that it tells lots of stories about Simeon. I've always been fascinated by Simeon, ever since we had a childhood Bible, my brother and I, and it had pictures. And I was rather more interested in the pictures than the words. And it had a jolly good illustration of Simeon lifting up the infant Christ. And I loved that picture. And ever since then, I have been fascinated by this character and by the story. And in the book, I try to flesh out a bit who Simeon was, who his friends might have been, what they might have thought of King Herod, who's a slightly Putin-esque figure.
And not a proper Jew, as they keep pointing out.
He wasn't the real McCoy.
He was Greek, was he?
Don't press me too hard on the details
here. I'm the one who should know.
But his he became Jewish, and he, of course, he did the tremendous thing of building the temple. And we talk nowadays about building booms, politicians building booms, you know, Macmillan in the 1950s, or we look at modern China and the speed with which they erect buildings. But it was like that in Herod's Jerusalem.
And this is what one of the things I love about Munk is that you capture the fabric of life in first century Jerusalem, or just about to be first century Jerusalem. But in many ways, it's not so different either from the world of Westminster that you've covered professionally, or the world of the cathedral close and the parish church. I hope listeners will remember that twice we've had your wonderful wife, Lois, organist, to talk about church music and
Indeed,
the fabric of life in Church
of
England.
She's still at it.
And we hope very much she'll come on as a guest again, because she's absolutely terrific. But I was just struck by the fact that people don't really change. There we are. We go from the 21st century to the first century. And Herod's building his temple, and the inhabitants are gossiping and bitching and teasing each other and moaning about rival Jewish sects and the Romans, of course, and the fact that Herod isn't really a Jew. And there are little questions like, who's going to dust the Holy of Holies? Because it's all very well to say that only the high priest can enter the Holy of Holies, but, you know, it's got to look neat and tidy.
Indeed.
It's rather like sort of flower lady type dispute. They get a non-Jewish slave to do it, don't they?
They
it's
do.
Those little details that I love.
And there is another detail in the book about the hinges of the gates of the temple being incredibly noisy. And this was actually the case.
Oh, really?
It is recorded that it was said that the hinges were so noisy that they could be heard in Antioch or something like that. I mean, they could be heard so far away, obviously. They couldn't be. But it was a tremendous exaggeration
that
of the times.
That must have been painful on a hot morning after a solid night.
It was Jericho, I think. But it was... These hinges really were fantastically noisy.
Yes.
And in that chapter, ouch, I think Herod has a toothache, or he's had a headache, and he doesn't want the gates to be open because they're too noisy. So I've tried to meld in. I mean, I am not a historian, but I did read a little bit around the subject. I mean, I'd say...
Didn't you do a postgraduate diploma in archaeology, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I did. That was a long time ago.
That
was
a long time ago.
Well, there is, I mean, there's an element. This book is partly an effort to evoke Colum Tabin's Testament of Mary, which is a tremendously serious and good book. But also there's elements here of Asterix the Gaul and also of The Life of Brian. So I tried to meld those two.
The Life of Brian reference, I wondered if I dared make it. It's inescapable because there are all these different Jewish sects and tribes. And the Pharisees drive everybody mad, don't they?
Yeah, I don't have the Judean people's front, but Pharisees...
They're not as annoying, perhaps, as the Zealots. Can you just give me a little flavour of the different types of Jew wandering around? Of course, there are non-Jews as well.
Well, there are the Sadducees, who are basically... They were the remainers of the day. They were the sort of elite who were quite keen on the Roman Empire.
Very high church.
High church, but also grand, socially grand. And I have a rather attractive lady, Zilla, who is, she is the society queen and tremendously indiscreet and with a ferocious sex drive. And she is one of the Sadducees. She knows everybody. She knows who all the important people are in the Sanhedrin. Sort of Lady Pamela Berry of her time, perhaps. And then you have the Pharisees, who are, they like gathering, they're keen on their nosebag, and they gather in this little coffee shop in Deuteronomy Square every day. And then the Zealots arrive for discussions, for negotiations with the Pharisees. And the main Zealot has a tremendously thick beard, a sort of real thing that you could delve a ditch with. This comes useful to his enemies in a fight, because they can just grab hold of his black beard and give him a punching.
And
at the
they're
same
terrific
time.
Boars, aren't they, the Zealots? They're wolfies, they're Citizen Smith.
A rather heavy company.
One of the things I loved about the book...
Sort of people you might find on other people's podcasts.
Exactly. One of the things I loved about the book are the little touches of Quentin, the, as I say, beloved Westminster sketch writer.
And not beloved by many, I'm afraid.
Well, you're not supposed to be beloved by them. You are by the readers. But just one little paragraph sums it up. Kedar was tall and lean, his beard so neat that its hems might have been sewn by a Galilee fisherwoman. He had not one twitch, but two, The first was a wriggle of the nose, the second a pouting of the lips, like a trumpeter between blasts. Now, that could so easily be some unfortunate junior minister who's caught the rough edge of Quentin Letts's pen. Or
there was a Conservative minister in the House of Lords who was a bit like that, I have to tell you, but he won't recognise himself, I'm sure. But, you know, the thing about human nature, Damien, is it doesn't change. And actually, the tremendous questions and the rivalries of human nature don't often alter that much. That's part of the effort of the book, is to try to reflect. We agonise, don't we, about our current times and about how it's never been this bad and the problems we face are unprecedented. Well, it's just not true. Everything has been faced before, including not only politics and the sort of personalities thrown up at us. I mean, maybe there's a bit of Donald Trump in some of King Herod, but also in the bigger questions that we personally face. So in the questions of life and love and death. And, you know, these things are, they're unchanging.
They are unchanging. I'm very keen to ask you about the darker side of the story, because it can't be ignored. But one of the things that doesn't change are bureaucrats and the ways bureaucrats express themselves. And for some reason, this made me laugh so much. Lemuel the architect, somehow less rich than the mason, complained that the whole temple had basically been ruined because his proposals for a domed visitor centre were rejected on cost grounds. Its circular cellar with oculus could have put Jerusalem on a par with Rome, and Lemuel was, quote, frankly disappointed that Herod had balked at the costs. And it was the frankly disappointed that made me roar with laughter, because that's... that's what people say at planning meetings, isn't it? Well, I'm frankly disappointed.
But it's but architects as well. I love architects. But I bet that they were just as impossible and egotistical in Herod's day as they are now. But of course, the horrible historical truth is that Herod is the one who's remembered, and not poor old Lemuel. You know, we've forgotten whoever Lemuel was, the Lemuel of his day, who designed the great temple of Jerusalem. And don't forget the speed with which they stuck up that temple. It was an amazing edifice, and we see the Wailing Wall today. That was just one of the, basically, one of the flying buttresses for it.
Yes,
I mean, it was just an extraordinary thing, and they stuck it up basically in 25 years, just over.
One of the things that gives real flavour to your narrative is the preoccupation with food. Food is mentioned on nearly every page. Oh, and it makes sense, because, you know, people didn't have cell phones to stare at, they didn't have newspapers to read, but they had food to think and talk about. And of course, Jewish food then, as now, was very different from Gentile food, and particularly Roman food. And I'd have to read you this. Tambal, who's a Nubian slave who can eat anything, had come to love Roman and Hellenic delicacies. Dormice stuffed with sugared pine kernels, snapper based with quince, crayfish in plums, camel heels a la Apicius. Anything with goose fat or syrup-found flavour, he would sink his hands into cinnamon-roasted filberts and shovel them down his throat like locusts, a childhood favourite in Nubia. For Levenses, it was chicken's brain boiled in narins or leftovers of pomegranate pot roast crane. Lemony lovage tartlets flew down the troot before you could say service. Peach halves in cumin custard vanished in a trice. Peacock and apple rissoles, caramelised pattern of jellyfish. Yep, jellyfish, muscat-jugged hare. Tambal found room for it all and would run a thumb round the bowl to secure the last of the goodness.
Well, old
so
Tambal...
So there were trenchermen in those days, as
there were,
today.
And actually, almost all those dishes did exist, according to a Roman cookery book.
It's a Picius's cookery book, I imagine.
Yeah, and but then poor old Tambal, who's my slave, my Nubian slave, the Pharisees talk to him and they say, look, if you convert to Judaism, then you will gain your liberty. And so he's quite interested in this proposal because he quite fancies getting home. But then, poor lad, he goes off for a feast with a Passover supper, and he's confronted by gefilte fish, and that's the end of it, because he finds it not quite as good as some of those jellyfish delicacies you were talking about just now.
It's such a funny tale, but of course you can never forget that the last thing Simeon will do in his life is recognise the Lord Jesus. Therefore, his life is coming to an end, and the novel has begun with somebody being told that they've got 6 months to live. Here's an interesting question for you, and I'm sure one that you've pondered. Do you think Simeon might be considered the first Christian?
I do. He was certainly the first Christian fatalist. Now, who was the first Christian? Was it John the Baptist? Well, actually, Simeon was before him, of course, because John the Baptist was still in nappies.
Yes, he was, yes.
Still in nappies at the time of Simeon. The thing about Simeon is that he goes to his death willingly and bravely and triumphantly. And this is surely the message of Christianity, is that there is triumph in death. And the prayer book says, in the midst of life, we are in death. Well, actually, you can invert that and say, in the midst of death, we are in life. And that's the hope of Christianity. And so I think that Simeon probably was the first Christian. But he is not widely known, Simeon. He's not as well known. He didn't have such a good PR man as John the Baptist. Although John the Baptist took it to extreme measures, of course, in the way that he left us. But Simeon is a fascinating character to me as well, because what forced him? The Bible doesn't tell us what his circumstances were before the angel told him, look, it's, you know, you're going to have to wait. So what was the backstory? And then, of course, in the ten verses we have in St. Luke about Simeon, it's not just about Simeon. There's also mention of an old woman called Anna, who's 80. And we learn nothing about the relationship between Anna and Simeon. Why does St. Luke mention them together? It seems to me perfectly possible, if not likely, that they had a relationship. And therefore, what was it that had forced Simeon? Did Simeon feel guilty about something? Was that the reason that he was waiting at the temple? And maybe had there been a love difficulty, or had he sinned in the past, perhaps with Anna? So those were these are some of the things I was trying to bite into. But I do it, I hope, in a not terribly sort of too clunking a way. And my great pin-up in this stylistically was Giovanni Guareschi. Don Camillo. You will remember Don Camillo, but some listeners will, but some won't know about it. Giovanni Guareschi, died in 1968, was an Italian author who wrote these delightful little stories about Don Camillo, who was a little priest in the Po Valley in the 1940s, who was always having feuds with the communist mayor, Peppone.
Right. Yes.
And the stories are they're quite episodic, they're charming, they're lighthearted. Don Camillo is not necessarily a very well-behaved priest. So I've tried in the layout of the stories and also of Nunc, and also in the way that my hero is, to try to echo the stories of Don Camillo. And I mention Giovanni Guareschi in the on the front page.
It's a lovely model. I read them on a family holiday to Spain in 1973. Now, it was a little bit more refined than the Are You Being Served? Costa del Sol holiday special. But my father had brought along the Don Camillo books, and I remember absolutely devouring them and thinking them completely
real
charming.
Bite-sized chunks, beautifully written, and also, you know, not too heavy in their Christian message. But I do think that Guareschi had a mission there.
And the dedication of your book is where you quote Giovanni Guareschi, and the book is dedicated in memoriam Penny and Alexander. And this is...
Those are my two siblings, yeah. Penny was my... I have still one sister living, but Penny died 2017, was at Cheltenham Ladies' College housemistress, and she died of cancer, aged 59, too young, as you know. And my brother Alexander was the world's fittest guy, businessman, very successful, and he died of cancer as well, 2021. And my brother, he fought it and fought his cancer. Was terribly fit bloke, but then his first grandchild arrived, and he lifted up his grandson in his arms, a bit like Simeon. And it was, I think, at that moment, and he told me it was a very powerful moment for him, that was the moment, I think, that he started coming to terms with his death. And he went to death in triumph. He was he went to death extraordinarily upbeat, and told me that, okay, he'd been in pain, but he said he was curious about death. And he said to me, his last words to me face to face were, see you the other side. And he was not a particularly religious bloke. But just to me, that was eerie, the echo of Simeon.
It was intensely moving for me because I lost my only sister to cancer in 2018. And I've talked about her so much that I have now given her a posthumous promise to cease disinterring her and telling her story to people on this podcast. But I don't know. I remember somebody saying, you know, you're getting old. When your grandparents die, it's in the natural order of things. Your parents die, that's painful, but you get used to it. When your friends start dying, that's really a horrific shock. And when your siblings die, that's something you're not expecting. I wasn't expecting to. It was my younger sister. We just buried our mother. And so...
It skittles you.
I feel the pain, the... is the protagonist of your novel modelled on your brother? Because I
not
can
really,
see bits
no.
of Quentin in him.
I don't think a character in fiction is ever directly a direct correlation. So there are lots of things going on there. But certainly Alexander towards the end comes out a bit, and in that moment of lifting up the child. You see, the Bible is extraordinary, isn't it? The Bible, New Testament, is terribly good on Jesus. It's not bad on St. Paul. It's not bad on Mary, a bit of Mary Magdalene. But some of the other characters, we get far too little of them. And therefore, I think it's a really good hunting ground for novelists. And so, for instance, I mean, I've had a go at Simeon. Michael Arditi has had a go, Old Testament, this, at King David. But consider someone like Onesimus, the slave that St. Paul writes about in the letter to Colossians. And do you remember St. Paul says, look, I've got this bloke. He's writing to Onesimus's boss. Onesimus has run away, and St. Paul says, look, why don't you consider having him back, but as a friend rather than as a one-to-one rather than as a slave? But we never hear afterwards what happened to Onesimus, do we? So did he go back to Philemon, his boss? Did he then become a very clement owner of slaves himself, or did he set people free? I just, you know, there you feel that there is a lot more chewing gum to be stretched there. Then you look at someone like Pilate or Pilate's wife. We never hear what happened to those two, or even to Caiaphas. You know, I'd like to know a little bit if there's a bit of comeuppance. And also, you know, Lazarus. Did he make use of his extra time? Or did he just...
One would hope so.
But he may have just gone to the casino.
Now, something I did wonder was, did you visit Jerusalem?
No.
Did you research for this?
I'd love to go to Jerusalem.
It is wonderful. I mean, you will enjoy it so much because the old city of Jerusalem has, in many respects, changed so little. But it is a shock to discover that the scene of, you know, Jesus's passion... Probably the scene of the crucifixion and the resurrection is no bigger than an English cathedral town, and in some respects resembles one.
Yeah, I'd love to
certainly
go.
Certainly with a different tribe.
I feel a bit of a fraud having written a book about Jerusalem and not having been there. But you know, Kazuo Ishiguro did much the same with England.
Nobody would guess that you hadn't been there.
The you feel that those stones of Jerusalem must have so much in them, must have so many memories, and I do have a little story about a tree. An olive tree that is planted in the book, and I imagine it still being there today, even though the square itself may long have been torn down. But trees live for a heck of a long time, don't they? And we have yew trees in Herefordshire that are over 1,000 years old.
You mentioned that the prayer book says that in the midst of life we're in death, and it is a theme in the book. It's inescapable because I went to your book launch and then had to leave early because the cat was screaming her head off back home and the neighbours were complaining. But before I left, I ran into one of my favourite people, and I know one of your closest friends, Jeremy Leesaw, the brilliant illustrator of Nunc. There are little there are little cartoons at the front of every chapter, and they are exquisitely done.
Again, this is a bit of an echo of Don Camillo, but Giovanni Guareschi did his own cartoons, and I simply can't draw, but I'm very lucky to know Jeremy. And he's done these beautiful drawings, and they're quirky, and he'd drawn beautifully the animals. There are quite a few animals in the story.
He's a lovely guy whose skill has just... I mean, his cartoons keep getting better and better.
One of the pictures that Jeremy has drawn is of the three wise men. And of course, it's always baffled me that the three wise men are considered wise, because the three, I describe them in the book, as three blundering eejits.
Yes.
They go in and they alert Herod to the existence of this pretender. And therefore, I have no doubt that the people of Jerusalem, and indeed of Bethlehem, felt very differently about the Magi and did not regard them as great authorities.
But anyway, the reason I mentioned in the midst of life, we were in death, is that this is true even at Nunc's book launch, because I ran into Jeremy, so pleased to see him, explained I had to run off to look after the cat, and said, we must get together. We absolutely must, maybe with Quentin. And he said, absolutely we must, because let's be honest, we're soon going to be dead.
We are, Damien. I mean, it's a grim thought, but it comes to us all. And the secret is to try to find a way of approaching it with the sort of curiosity that my brother faced it. And he was a remarkable example for us all.
I cannot recommend Nunc too highly. Quentin, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you very much indeed.
To be.